Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Matt Alagaya. On the show today, I'll be joined in the studio by the writer Lucy Jones and theatre critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolfe, to talk about what's on the small screen and the West End stage this week. Plus, we'll learn about an art heist that took a couple of Van Gogh paintings on a trip from Amsterdam to Italy. We'll be speaking to Hannah Andrews, producer of London's music, art and tech festival Convergence. And later on, Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here to talk us through Morocco's music chart. That's all to come on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Lucy and Matt, welcome to the show. Now, we're going to begin things with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which has just opened at the Harold Pinter Theatre here. This classic play by Edward Albee follows the story of a middle-aged academic husband and wife who draw a younger couple into their disintegrating relationship. Matt, this has quite the cast. Us through the who's playing who in this.
Well, it's a non-American cast playing a quintessentially American play and doing it very, very well. The female lead, Martha, I guess, who is best remembered from Elizabeth Taylor's Oscar-winning performance in the movie, is the, I'm sure, soon-to-be Dame Imelda Staunton, but she isn't a dame quite yet. Opposite her is, speaking of TV, Game of Thrones star Conleth Hill, brilliant as George, her bespectacled academic husband, but in this production he's lost his glasses, which is interesting. And the young couple who come calling on them are Luke Treadaway, late of War Horse and Curious Since the Dog in the Nighttime, and then the rising film actress Imogen Poots. So yeah, it's a pretty starry quartet.
And in terms of how they create the atmosphere, I guess when I think of this play, I think of claustrophobia and I think of very kind of, restricted space. Right. How do they sort of do this on stage?
The play essentially is a long-day's journey through the night. It's a drink-fueled pressure cooker where the central couple needle and needle and needle and they play games and then the games turn sour and then the game's no longer funny and the whole sort of elaborate artifice by which they've constructed their lives collapses. And they ensnare into their web, as it were, this younger couple who might be a kind of lesser version of them someday. But the point is that you have to feel as if you are kind of trapped in this hothouse, which this quartet does amazingly well. Imelda Staunton is interesting casting for Martha because you tend to think of Martha's being big and blousy. And Kathleen Turner, for instance, was a very memorable Martha. And Imelda Staunton's tiny. But within that kind of diminutive frame is a woman of incredible power. But it isn't just the Imelda Staunton show, nor would she want it to be. She's not that kind of performer. She's incredibly selfless. And so she surrounded herself with very, very good people. And I cannot commend Conleth Hill strongly enough as George. He's a Northern Irish actor in real life who has not really done this kind of thing on stage before. It's as I say, the Richard Burton part on screen. And he tends to come under in the dynamic of the piece, whereas Imelda goes over. That's deliberate. And they meet brilliantly halfway.
So is there one standout performance, or do you think it's a very...
Oh, that would be invidious. I think they do work as a perfectly synchronized quartet.
And it's directed by James McDonald and produced by Sonia Friedman. How have they handled the original? I mean, it's a play, as I said, that lots of people know already very well.
Yeah.
Have they stayed true to the text?
Yes, and that's actually a really good question, because the norm nowadays with revivals of classic plays here and on Broadway is to deconstruct them and set them God knows where, usually somewhere entirely placeless and unrecognizable. So when the curtain goes up here and you're actually in the living room that George and Martha happen to call home, it's kind of surprising because you think nowadays you could be in a crater on the moon. So they're quite respectful towards the text, but within that they mine it for, I think, new shadings. It doesn't sound like a lot of Virginia Woolf's I've heard before. For instance, Imogen Poots' Honey, the part played by Sani Dennis in the movie, that's often played as a giggly caricature. And she actually plays her as kind of a tragic lost soul who's so sort of adrift in drink that she really doesn't know which way is up. And it's, I think, a fantastic performance.
And in terms of the set, is it fairly conventional? Are we in the sort of the academic townhouse that we...
I mean, it's 1960s New England and, George is a professor who married into money. Martha is the daughter of the president of the university. She has more money, we're led to believe, than he does. I wouldn't say it's an elegant home. It's a lived-in home. It's seen a lot of anger, and it's going to see a lot more anger throughout the 3 hours of the play.
Fantastic. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is on at the Harold Pinter Theatre until the 27th of May. Let's move on now to An American in Paris, which is on at the Dominion Theatre. On screen, it's won Oscars, and on Broadway, it won Tonys. But this is its West End premiere. This is a big budget musical that's won a lot of praise, Matt. Does it live up to the hype?
It does. I saw it on Broadway and I saw it here. The extraordinary selling point of it are the two lead performances by the two dancers, and they are dancers first and everything else second, who did it on Broadway, Robert Fairchild, who's a principal of New York City Ballet, and Leanne Cope, who's a member of the Royal Ballet here. And it's a big gamble casting dancers in a Broadway show, because if you're in a ballet company, the one thing you don't do is 8 or even 7 performances a week. You might do 7 performances across 3 weeks because dancers' regimens don't work in a Broadway way. So it was a big gamble on behalf of the production to give a chance to these two. And they've risen to the occasion beautifully in New York and now in London. The director of it, Christopher Wheeldon, is making his musical theater directing debut after many decades here with the Royal Ballet in New York with New York City Ballet. And he's great because he knows how to power a story through movement. That's the challenge with this kind of thing. It's based, everyone probably knows, on the 1951 Gene Kelly movie, female leading lady Leslie Caron, who's still alive and was at a performance apparently the other night. But the movie musical doesn't sort of sing all the way through. This sings and dances all the way through. So they've had to give it a completely new energy and impetus and also tweak the storyline.
Okay, interesting. So maybe it would be helpful to just remind our listeners of the storyline and what changes they've made to that.
In the movie, it's kind of this idyll of Parisian life in and around 1951, which is when the movie came out. In the stage show, they've pushed the period further back. So it's taking place right after the Second World War. Vichy France is a painful memory. The occupation of Paris is kind of on everyone's lips, but remains unspoken. It's traumatic. And the idea is that from this traumatic recent history emerges this explosion of joy, which the musical goes on to celebrate. And we cannot praise highly enough the contribution of Bob Crowley, the scenic designer, who really is, and I use this word very sparingly, but he really is a genius, a visual genius. And what he does in kind of the opening 5 or 10 minutes of the show is just tell you, before anything's really happened, he tells you in visual terms about Paris then, you know, during the war, and now as it's about to be released into something more colorful, just through his use of the color palette. And it's absolutely ravishing. The designs are glorious. I'd go back and see it just to look at it.
And I mean, not all, Broadway smash hits kind of survive the transition to the West End. Just on what you've seen, do you think this has got what it takes to do very well in London?
Yes, but it has two tricky things working against it, which has nothing to do with the quality of the piece. One is that the Dominion Theatre where it's playing, although We Will Rock You, the Queen musical, ran there for over a decade, but nonetheless, it's still a tricky house, and a lot of shows don't necessarily take to it. We Will Rock You, I think, did because it was essentially a rock concert in a West End house. The other thing, which I'm sure the producers of American Paris are slightly irritated by, is that it's opening within a couple of weeks of a big London revival of 42nd Street. And 42nd Street, which is a much earlier musical from 1983, is kind of the ultimate Broadway dance musical with a cast of thousands. And whereas when this was in New York, this was the only dance musical in town, here they're going to be two major dance musicals opening within several weeks of each other. And 42nd Street isn't sophisticated. It doesn't have any depth. It doesn't really have anything to say, but it does have lots of tap dancing and it has lots of chorus girls. So it depends what the punters want from a night out.
Interesting. And in terms of, I mean, obviously La La Land won a lot of Oscars last month. It may be a bit of a stretch to say that there's a revival of musicals going on, but is that something that you see? I mean, I guess, yeah, are we kind of ready to have that kind of escapism again?
Well, it's really funny, Matt, that you say that, because as I was leaving the theater last Thursday to press preview, I overheard an American guy, not me, somebody else saying, oh, yeah, it's just like La La Land, but set in wartime France. And I thought, oh, maybe. And there have been discussions about how even the ad campaigns for the two pieces, for this musical and also for the movie, kind of mirror each other. I think, you know, dance is sexy now. Dance is a thing. Dance, obviously, you know, Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling, brilliant though they are not Robbie Fairchild and Leanne Cope, as they would be the first to admit. So if you got a taste for it in La La Land and you want to see it in three dimensions live, here's the place to go.
An American in Paris is on at the Dominion Theatre until the 30th of September. Matt Wolff, thanks very much for your theatre review. Now, before we turn to Lucy Jones for our TV review this week, we're going to nip to the Netherlands. One of the most famous art heists in modern history was finally laid to rest this week after two priceless Van Goghs were returned to display at the Amsterdam Museum from where they were stolen in 2002. Their unveiling after 14 years of absence is all the more remarkable because it coincides with the release of a Dutch documentary where the thief at the heart of the story finally confesses to the crime he has served time for. Monocle's Amsterdam correspondent Venetia Rainey reports.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you all have come here not really to hear us speak, but of course to see the painting. So we are ready to unveil the works now.
This was the thrilling moment that two stolen Van Gogh paintings were put back on display at Amsterdam's Van Gogh Museum after a 14-year absence. The final chapter in a story that includes a daring art heist, an Italian mafia figure's mother, and a last-minute confession on camera.
It was a very simple heist in a certain way, because the only thing they had to do was smash a window, go in the museum, and within 3 minutes they were out again and they were gone.
Filmmaker Vincent Verwij has spent the last year following one of the thieves convicted of the crime, Octave Durham, as he searched for the pictures in an ultimately unsuccessful attempt to clear a hefty debt he owes to the museum. Durham served over 25 months in prison for the robbery a decade ago, but has only just admitted to being guilty in Verwij's film.
Ja, die is gewoon achtergebleven. Die is naar het lab gegaan. En als die man hier die aan het schoonmaken was naar rechts had gekeken, had hij ons gezien. En dan hadden we het niet gered, want die zou gelijk gaan bellen of wat dan ook.
In the documentary, which aired in the Netherlands this week, Durham explains everything about the 2002 theft that shook the Dutch art world and is listed by the FBI as one of the top 10 art crimes in the world. Verwij again.
He's done a lot of bank heists and burglaries in the past, and he was walking through the Paulus Potter Street where the museum is someday, and he thought, hey, there's a window there that I probably could get in. And he wanted to try that. He knew that art was sellable in the criminal world. He received, together with his buddy, 350,000 euros. That was split between them, so he had 175,000 euros for the paintings. He spent it on a new Mercedes and jewelry for his girlfriend. And within 6 weeks, it was all gone again.
That was the beginning of 14 long years in which the Van Gogh Museum tried in vain to recover the two paintings, View of the Sea at Scheveningen, painted in 1882, and Congregation Leaving the Reformed Church in Nuenen, painted in 1884 and 85. They are described as priceless. At first glance, the small, early period Van Gogh paintings are not especially striking. But as museum director Axel Ruger explains, they are hugely important works.
The beach view is the only painting in our collection that he painted during his short period in when he was living in The Hague. So that was an enormous gap, of course, when that had gone missing. And the small church from Nuenen, he painted as a gift to his mother. So, and then as in memory of his father also, he changed the picture later on after his father's death. Though it has, for the personal story, an enormous emotional value also. So in that sense, you know, these are two small gems that, you know, we're really missing from the collection.
In fact, for most of the 14 years, the paintings were with the person Durham sold them to, Italian mafia figure Raffaele Imperiale. They were eventually recovered last year during a raid of his mother's house near Naples, where they were found wrapped in cloth behind a trick wall. Ruger recalls his reaction when he first heard of the discovery while he was on holiday.
There was a mixture of hope and preparing yourself also for yet another disappointment, because over the course of the 14 years that the works were gone, we've had multiple parties approach us claiming that they knew where the works were, that they had tips, and it always led to nothing. And so, you know, we have had a bit of a roller coaster ride of hope and disappointment over the many years. But a day later, you know, we were certain. So then the joy was enormous.
Although the paintings were wrenched from their frames, which can cause enormous damage, they were in remarkably good condition when they were found.
You know, if the recovery is miracle number one, miracle number two is the condition of the works, because they are relatively unharmed. Only the beach view is somewhat damaged in the lower left corner. There's a piece missing, but that does not really disturb the overall image, as it were.
For Dutch Culture Minister Jet Bussemaker, who attended the unveiling of the paintings, their return to the Van Gogh Museum is a huge boon for the country.
The thieves did not only make a hole in the wall in the museum, but they also smashed a hole in Dutch cultural heritage, because Van Gogh is so important for us. And so now that they are back, the hole is repaired, and that we have the whole picture back again of who Van Gogh is for culture, for the history of painting, but also for Dutch society.
From now on, wannabe art thieves can be sure that they'll have to do much more than smash through a window to get their hands on any loot. For Monocle in Amsterdam, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thanks very much to Venetia Rainey for that report. You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya, and today I'm joined in the studio by the writer Lucy Jones and theatre critic for the International New York Times, Matt Wolfe. Lucy, we're going to turn to you now to talk TV. Here in the UK, one of the biggest bits of TV news this week was that the Australian soap Neighbours, which has been a favourite on British screens for several decades, might be dropped from Channel 5. Fremantle Media has denied this, but it's set off a frenzy of fans signing petitions to keep the show. Lucy, in a nutshell, what is the significance of Neighbours on British TV?
I feel a bit conflicted about Neighbours. I mean, I think as lots of people of my generation born in the 80s, it was a soap that we watched kind of throughout our childhoods, teenage years, through into university or our 20s, and it taught us about the everyday occurrences of life and relationships. It was always kind of a relaxing thing to watch. It was never kind of threatening or difficult. But maybe the cultural significance of it has kind of run its course. I had a look at the petition today, and only 13,000 people have signed it. And I know that lots of people feel very strongly about Neighbours, but there's lots of other great TV shows coming out of Australia at the moment. And I wonder if it's just not that kind of soap and that kind of format just isn't good enough today.
Interesting. I mean, I guess, yeah, 13,000 signatures when it's quite easy to sign a petition these days doesn't sound that good.
Yeah, although apparently the viewing figures are quite high. It's watched by a million people.
That is impressive.
Quite high. But like,
this also, I mean, you said that it taught you about life, but it also kind of taught you a certain Australian lifestyle, which is quite interesting. I mean, it has become a bit of a soft power tool. You know, people see that and they think of Australia and they think of sun and good-looking people. What do you think it's done for Neighbours, for Australia's image and kind of reputation abroad?
I think people feel very kind of affectionate towards Australia because of it. And I mean, I'm sure there's lots of stereotypes in it that are a bit lazy. But, you know, my only experience of Australians until I became good friends with an Australian in my late teens was Susan and Carl and Harold Bishop. You know, and I love those guys. And I feel like if I went to Australia, it would kind of feel like home. But I'm not sure I'd much rather read, I suppose, I don't know, Aboriginal literature or something to learn more about Australia.
There's probably more in that, I would imagine, yeah. Okay, well, let's turn now to the shows that you've been watching this week, Lucy. Sure. We'll begin with Big Little Lies, the new show from HBO, with an all-star cast led by Reese Witherspoon. Lucy, let's start with the plot. What happens in this? What's this about?
Okay, so it's basically a kind of domestic mystery, I suppose, and it opens in Monterey, and it focuses particularly on three women. So that's Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, and Laura Dern, and they're all kind of highly glossy, affluent mothers who all have children at the same school. And within the first kind of half hour, it's clear that we're in the aftermath of a murder. So something has happened at a trivia night, and we're not sure who's died or who's done the killing or what's going on. What is immediately clear is that there's a lot of tension and there's a lot of kind of emotional upheaval that's going to happen, and nothing is quite as it seems. There's a new mum in town who comes with a little boy, and we kind of see and view the situation through her eyes. She's brilliant though, and actually lots of people are focusing on Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, but in fact her performance I think is really emotionally effective. And her little boy is accused of choking one of the little girls at school, and the plot then blows up from that point. So it's about that. It's focused on a murder, but it's about a lot more, specifically about the marriages, the three key marriages. And I think, from what I can tell, it's about five episodes in, we're closing in on one of the marriages, which is Nicole Kidman's to Alexander Skarsgård. And, you know, behind all the beautiful blow dries and grosgrain wallpaper and kitchen islands, there is some really dark violence happening. So her relationship is immediately, you see, it's quite physically abusive. And it's also about, I think it's about the perpetuation of abuse in families and how patterns continue and how patterns can be broken. So I think it's about lots of things. It was based on a 2014 novel by an Australian writer called Leanne Moriarty, which means, and I was mentioning this to Matt earlier, it's going to be, well, I assume one series. It's a mini series, I think, of eight episodes. It's directed by Jean-Luc Vallée, who directed Dallas Buyers Club. And when I first started watching it, I thought it might be a bit cliched and kind of hackneyed, slightly rote the, for example, the relationship between Reese Witherspoon as a mother and her teenage daughter was quite kind of hackneyed and obvious. And I wondered whether the relationships between the mothers would descend into just kind of catty bitch fighting. In fact, from the second episode, I think it picks up quite a lot and you see the characters deepening and there's a lot more ambiguity going on. And it's also really beautiful.
Okay, well, we've got a very short clip, actually, that we can play. This is a clip of Big Little Lies.
Everybody wants to prove who's the richest.
We're talking about viciously competitive people.
And at the root of it was Madeline. Exactly how psychotic do you think I am? He's a lot younger than her.
Celeste.
She must be pretty, you know.
So bad.
We are so bad.
Jane just didn't fit here.
Thought it was nice for the nannies to get to know each other.
Jane is not a nanny.
Kind of like a dirty old Prius parked outside of Barney's.
She's a mom. She's young. Like you used to be?
Like we used to be?
Bitch.
That was a clip there of Big Little Lies. Matt, this is also something that you've been kind of following closely, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't get to watch much TV, so I haven't seen it yet, but I did read an interview with Reese Witherspoon recently in the New York Times where she said it's the most exciting thing she's ever been part of. And she worked very, very hard to make it happen, and it was kind of a celebrate. The interview was kind of a celebration of girl power. At last, women are in the driver's seat. Does it come across that way?
I think it does. I think it will draw comparisons to something like Desperate Housewives. And I don't think that the kind of, you know, the suburban darkness is a new subject area. However, it's becoming quite clear that like I said, the ambiguities and ambivalences between the women and how they kind of present themselves is complex. There's a beautiful moment with her and her teenage daughter where, you know, they're constantly kind of fighting and misunderstanding each other. And then there's a tender moment when she says, you know, you lose your babies, you have to let them go, type thing. And it's very moving. And I think it's just going to get better.
I just think it's so interesting. I mean, we know this, but it's always worth being reminded how many great people now do TV. Mm. I mean, you know, in the old days, you wouldn't have thought an Oscar-winning actress, well, two of them, Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, why would they bother with TV? But now, actually, TV seems more interesting.
Yeah. And I think we're moving into a time where the A-listers are doing it. You know, I wouldn't be surprised now if you saw kind of Leonardo DiCaprio doing a TV show. I mean, they're clearly seeing that this is where the interesting stories are being told.
And so, is it because they have a bit more sort of creative freedom in this format, where they have, you know, directors have 10 hours or even 20 hours to do a series and really do a story justice and really do a character arc justice? Is that what it is, basically, do you think?
I think that's a really good point, and it must be that, you know, it gives them simply the time to, I mean, a film of Big Little Lies could have been made. It could have been 2.5 hours long. It's quite a short novel, but having the time exactly to kind of go deep on a character. I think also a director like Vallée in Big Little Lies, I mean, it's edited and shot so creatively. Like, the ocean is a big character. They're always staring out to the sea. He plays with silence really well. There are times when, like, the sound gets completely cut at really interesting kind of psychological moments. It starts with the red and blue police lights flickering and it becomes a kind of weird purple haze. And all you can hear is a woman breathing and she's clearly in a flight or flight mode. And all these little things kind of just create something quite cinematic. So I think, you know, Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, whereas before they might have sneered at the small screen, you know, clearly this is where great art is being made now.
Big Little Lies is showing now on HBO in the US, Sky Atlantic in the UK, and Showcase in Australia. Finally, Lucy, we'll end with Baskets. This show by FX has just begun its second season over in the US, and it follows a wannabe professional clown called Chip Baskets, portrayed by Zach Galifianakis. He's also one of the creators of the show alongside American comedian Louis C.K. First of all, let's hear a quick clip.
What kind of clown jobs are you looking for?
What about that thing where clowns are showing up in towns and spooking children?
Yeah, it's happening in a lot of places.
Can you find out if that's a paid situation?
I don't have any practical skills. My IQ is iffy at best. I went to France to study to become a clown, but I don't think clowns are needed as much since the world has become so clownish.
There's train tracks out and back. Maybe you want to start riding the rail again.
That was a clip of the FX show Baskets there. Lucy, what was the success of the first season, and has the second season so far lived up to it?
So I am obsessed with Baskets. I think it's the best show on TV. I absolutely love it. I don't think it's been particularly successful. I mean, season one was on FX. It's also on Hulu. I think it has a bit of a cult following. Like you said, it's written co-written by Louis C.K.
Who has Zach. A cult following himself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And Zach Galifianakis, too, who plays Chip Baskets, the clown, and also the twin brother, Dale, of Chip Baskets. The most genius thing about Baskets is Baskets' mother, who's played by the comedian Louis Anderson, who's a man, and he plays Christine, and she is kind of a bit of a downtrodden, extremely overweight mother who's always kind of battling with trying not to eat too much cake and her wayward sons. She is the most charming, funny, moving, touching character I've seen on the screen for a long time. Like the pursing of her lips or the emphasis on a syllable. I mean, to watch her, it's just a complete joy, and it's so emotionally authentic. So in series two, which is it is on currently, she comes to the fore, and her character is kind of given permission to find happiness. Baskets, I mean, not much happens in it. It's more, I suppose it's on the line of something like Arrested Development or Napoleon Dynamite. You know, it's more about the kind of emotional lives and the relationships between the characters. But series two, yeah, sees her trying to find some happiness. She kind of meets a man. And it's also about another female character who is in love with Chip Baskets called Martha Kelly. She's a Californian stand-up comic and she's brilliant. She plays this kind of beleaguered, downtrodden, very deadpan woman. And it's just a show where in 1 minute you'll be laughing and the next you'll be crying. It's extremely touching.
And is it kind of laugh out loud funny? Because I guess I'm trying to think what the comedy is. Is it surreal or is it kind of quirky or is it just, you know, laugh out loud jokes as well?
It is. It's very surreal, exactly. It's surreal and quirky. I mean, series two opens with Chip Baskets has fallen in with a lot of kind of squatters, hippies, including a drug-addled flautist called Morpheus. And this group are called things like Cypher and Mouse. And they walk around playing panpipes, which kind of throws up a lot of comedic situations. It's a black comedy, and there is some really bleak moments. I've got some friends who've actually given up watching it because it's too depressing. But I rarely laugh at TV, and I laugh maybe 5 times per episode.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
As far as ratios go, that's good.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that Galifianakis doesn't play just Chip, he also plays his twin brother Dale. How does he do in that kind of dual role?
He does well. I mean, Dale is slightly corny. He's successful and he has this unexplained southern accent. And he's a kind of like, they're kind of Janus-faced duo of Chip Baskets. Even though he's quite horrible to Martha, you're rooting for him. Whereas Dale, you know, not so good. But he does a good job. And there's a lot of slapstick in this series. There's one quite long scene where they have this huge fight and they absolutely wreck their mother Christine's house. And it's very kind of childish and slapsticky, but really funny. And they managed to film that really cleverly. I was kind of watching how they did it with the. He obviously has a double. But I think it's really underrated and people aren't really talking about it. And I think it's absolutely brilliant.
Baskets is airing on FX now. Thanks very much to Lucy Jones there for talking us through this week's TV shows. This week in London, Convergence Festival kicks off. The music, art and technology event holds live performances, talks and workshops around the city and has entertained and educated over 100,000 attendees since it began in 2014. Hannah Andrews is the producer of this year's affair and she tells Monocle's Holly Fisher here what we can expect from the bumper lineup.
Convergence Sessions is part of Convergence Festival, which is a festival of music, art and technology, and
and sessions are really the kind of meeting of minds of the festival. So where we have talks, workshops, debates, screenings, installations, performances, all of which explore innovation and celebrate innovation at the intersection of art, music and technology.
When last year's Convergence ended, what was the first meeting like about what are we going to do next year?
Well, I actually joined the festival in August last year, which was a little bit after March kind of wrapped up, but was right at the beginning of when conversations started happening. I mean, it's always a funny process. It's always a journey where what you say at the beginning invariably ends up very different at the end. But really, it was just thinking about what we wanted to achieve, what we wanted audiences to experience that were attending sessions. And that was this sense of ideas sharing, of really celebrating transferable knowledge, about creating a platform for audiences to learn but also share, and for speakers to share this idea of almost an equal platform and celebration of incredible people doing incredible things, both speakers and audience alike.
And I suppose when you're dealing with the topic of tech, it changes so much all the time. It's just constant new developments. Do you find that when, you know, you might have had some thoughts in your head about what you want to do in August, but then maybe by December something's happened and you want to rip it all up and start again?
Well, there are two points to make about that. One is that for that very reason, I kept programming flexible as long as was possible. So we maintained about 10 to 20% of programming open until about a month ago, which is quite cavalier, but I think is necessary when it comes to programming a tech-centered event, because you want to be able to capture the moment. And we've ended up having some really awesome final additions to the program that do just that. We've got an open process workshop that's hacking into new technologies to create audio sensory VR experiences. And that, like, bringing that in at this point was awesome, because it meant that we could really just capitalize on what is coming on out right now. And then the other point is, from my perspective, if something is idea-driven as opposed to tech-driven, it doesn't matter at what point you release that. Something that is idea-driven or was idea-driven 6 months ago will still be exciting now if that idea is exciting in itself. And I think that's where it's really important when consuming, producing, engaging with music, art and technology, to really consider, at least in my opinion, whether the piece is driven by the idea or whether it's driven by the technology.
Music and art's relationship with technology is interesting because they're both mediums that have taken it on board creatively very well, but perhaps it took them a long time to adapt commercially. Are you interested in both sides of that? Are you interested in how they use it creatively or how the industries are using tech in terms of platforms and selling stuff as well?
Definitely interested in both. I think there's a real moment right now to engage in conversation about how artists promote their work and how valid it is to be an artist / entrepreneur. And those conversations do come in two sessions. There's going to be a really awesome presentation to open up the whole 2 days, actually, by the creative director of another space, which grew out of UVA, United Visual Artists, and another space is the more events-based commercial branch of that. And that as a model is really interesting. So he'll be discussing how art has developed from, you know, patronage back in the 1700s to this very, very nuanced balance between art, design, commerce, producing and creativity. So I think it's a really interesting point for conversation, because tech is disrupting everything at the moment, and that disruption can be good, that disruption can be bad. And again, I think it comes back to the idea, and it comes back into the integrity of what is being produced.
So let's talk a bit about who is on the lineup. I mean, you've got Friday today, and tomorrow we've got an amazing lineup of people speaking. Talk us through some of the highlights.
Oh, where to start? I feel very privileged to have been involved in this programme, to be working with so many brilliant people. I'm particularly excited. On Friday, we've got an event called Meeting of Minds, and that we have realised with the support of the British Council, which has been awesome because it's meant that we could bring all sorts of incredible individuals from the four corners of the world over to discuss the future of art, technology and music, the ramifications of it, how we ensure it remains diverse and exciting, how we can realise its fullest potential. And we've got the curator of Sonar Plus D, we have the curator and artistic director of Nuit Sonore, we have the artistic director of Electra in Quebec. We've got all sorts of really fascinating people coming over to discuss with curators from the V&A, from the Barbican and artists, how this very potent field of music, art and technology can really be maximised. So that is going to be awesome. In the evening on Friday, I'm also really excited. We've got a whole programme based around subversion, so the idea of looking for moments and new cultures that are sub the mainstream. We've got Marshmallow Laserfee speaking, we have Warp Records hosting a panel, and then that is going to be interrupted by a performance piece that is presented by Holly Blakey, Gwilym Golden, Darkstar. And that is a really exciting moment for us because the idea of a panel being interrupted by a performance that is so collaborative, so experimental, should be wicked. And then we've got Mr. Mitch in the evening, who performed last night, started with the sound of a rooster, ended with the sound of classical music, and in between you were just like, my mind is blown.
And speaking of collaborations, you've got Holly Blakey, who's a choreographer, and Darkstar, who are sort of an electronic duo, and Gwilym Gold, who's a musician. How do these collaborations come together?
I can't take credit for that collaboration myself. That was really my co-producer, Philippa, who joined us a few months ago and was awesome in suggesting that particular piece. She showed it to us as she's worked with Holly before, and we were like, this is awesome, let's get it involved. So whilst we didn't put that collaboration together, what we did love about it was this idea of experimentation, of unusual people coming together and using sessions as a platform for that. And that's what we really look for in everybody that we program, is this sense of experimenting with your ideas through the event. And I think that's why we get so many interesting complimentary talks.
That was Hannah Andrews here in London. Head to convergencelondon.com for more information. Now, before we finish the show, let's welcome Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco into the studio for our global countdown. Now, you've just got back from Morocco, and I believe that's where we're heading for the countdown this week. Is that right?
Absolutely. I was inspired with my trip. I went to Marrakesh for a holiday, 5 days. But, you know, I did listen to quite a good music there, actually. And if you look at the charts, I was happy because, you know, I think last week we discussed how Ed Sheeran's number one everywhere in the world. But it's nice to see that in Morocco, that, for example, the top five, there's three local artists on the top five. That's always good, in my opinion, in the charts. And they're quite good songs. I'll give you a little countdown, and then until we find who is number one.
Fantastic.
Number five, we have Zuhair Bahawi with Tsala Lia Sode. So basically, Zuhair, he started as a rapper in Morocco. But now I think he wanted to expand the number of listeners. So now he's a bit like the Moroccan Justin Bieber in a way. You know, the video clip looks quite expensive. There was a swimming pool in it. And he looks even a bit sexy in a way as well. Yep, I approve number five. Number four, that's an interesting one, Matt, because it's Ariana Grande and Nicki Minaj. Side to side. I say interesting because, you know, Moroccan is kind of a conservative country, but that track's particularly very sexual in a way. there's lines like wrist icicle, right dick bicycle. You know, it's very controversial, but it's number four. It's playing on the radio. Maybe, I hope, I'm not sure if they understand the lyrics all the time, but it's number three. We have a very heavy ballad by Dozy with El Mouja. You know, he's a traditional balladeer from Moroccan, from Morocco as well. Again, I saw the video clip, a lot of rain, a lot of sadness. It's
a classic ballad then.
A classic ballad. I could see that as an Eurovision entry as well. Okay. Number two, very quickly, Ed Sheeran, Shape of You.
Of course.
It's everywhere, guys. You know, it's
unavoidable.
Unavoidable, yeah, exactly. Even in Morocco.
You went as far away as possible and Ed Sheeran's still number two.
Yes.
Yeah, what's number one?
Well, let's play a clip first.
Omerik netik el gavbe
That was Ibsen Tisket with Menek Vele Mene.
Very good.
Hope my Arabic pronunciation is good here.
That sounded good to me.
It's quite a good track, I have to say. I think, you know, I could see, you know, it sounds very kind of Western with some Arabic elements, of course. Just so you know, it's interesting because people say, oh, is it the death of the reality show, the music talent shows? I don't think so. I think it's still strong in quite a few countries in the world. For example, she was a contestant on the Arab Idol TV show and also on the Star Academy Arab World. I think, you know, not only Morocco, but all over the Middle East, those shows are still very popular. I mean, not only the Middle East, everywhere else as well. So I believe this is one of her, you know, her third single, which is doing very, very well.
Fantastic. Guys, we've still got Matt and Lucy with us. What did you make of that? Any thoughts on Moroccan music and the charts?
I was quite interested by the beat of it. I thought it was quite an unusual beat.
Sort of stuttering, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm a bit out of touch, to be honest, but I quite liked it.
You're out of touch with the Moroccan charts? Unbelievable. Matt, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I haven't been to Morocco in about a decade, so I clearly have to rush back and bone up on my music. But I'm glad to hear it isn't all just five versions of Ed Sheeran in the top five. It's nice that there's room for others.
And they like electro rap, I think. That's the conclusion we can have from Morocco.
Absolutely. Well, listen, thanks very much, Fernando. That was excellent. That brings us to the end of today's show, I'm afraid. Thanks very much to my guests, Lucy Jones and Matt Wolfe. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us at the same time again next week. But for now, here's the rest of that number one track, Menek Wela Meni. سيدي لا تعذبني اللي بيني وبينك ساغة لا ما نجيك ما جيني غير سيرو خليني بكيت لعيني درت في قلبي حدا منك ولا مني ما بقيش هممني